Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome, my friends, to the Bob and Brad podcast. My name is Mike Kienitz, and today I am interviewing an orthopedic surgeon named Meredith Warner. She has recently written a book called Bone on Bone, An Orthopedic Surgeon's Guide to Avoiding Surgery and Healing Pain Naturally. We'll be talking about lots of different alternative routes to healing pain you may be having related to arthritis or other similar issues. So without further ado, here's Meredith. Welcome to the program, Dr. Warner. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Mike.
So we are going to be talking about a book you have written, which is available for pre-order now, coming out in May, and it's called Bone on Bone, An Orthopedic Surgeon Guide to Avoiding Surgery and Healing Pain Naturally. Now, I did not expect that to hear from an orthopedic surgeon.
Right. And that, I think, in a nutshell, is the fundamental problem.
Yes.
You know, if you are a hammer, everything is a nail.
Sure.
That is a myth I'm trying to dispel.
So to begin, would you mind telling us a bit about your journey as an orthopedic surgeon and what led you to write this book?
Sure. So I did my residency at Tulane in New Orleans, went to medical school in Jefferson in Philadelphia. And, you know, when you're a resident, at that time we were working 100, 120 hours a week, not sleeping. So you're sleep deprived. You're just trying to learn basics. So there's not a lot of time for, I guess, deep thought or start trying to question or reflect or improve, which you're just trying to learn the fundamentals of surgery, of looking at x-rays, of doing a physical exam, et cetera. After residency, I did 4 years active duty in the military. So that was interesting because first I started in New Orleans, which is sort of like a war zone sometimes. And then I actually got deployed to war zones. And so then you're treating true injuries, you know, like gunshot wounds, bomb blasts, car accidents, everything like that. And so again, it's all very mechanical, very broken femur, put nail in, fix, look at x-rays, is it reduced, et cetera, et cetera. So again, no time for reflection or deep thought, but over time, and I was a resident right when the opioid epidemic was sort of becoming a thing, and when OxyContin reps were still coming around to the clinics and stuff. And so I kind of started to see this growth of people not ever getting better and needing more and more narcotics, despite the fact that all of our trade journals were talking about all of these improvements in our technology and, you know, the wear rates of plastic and the total knees are better and our surgery is better and our suture anchors are better. You know, all this technical stuff's improving. But meanwhile, I'm seeing these patients come into clinic who are just never getting better. I see in the community more and more people addicted to narcotics. The disability rates go up, et cetera, et cetera. So I started to sit back and think and read a little bit more about basic science. And then I got into nutrition and then I got into natural medicine. And I realized that we are missing the boat in ortho as to A, what is the fundamental problem with the mechanical aspects of the human body, the musculoskeletal system? And then B, what do we do about it? Because what we're doing isn't really achieving population-wide outcomes that we would want.
Sure. So if people want to find out more information about you, where can they go?
Well, I have my practice has a website, and also I have a natural medicine company that I started during this journey, which we can talk about if you want. The best place to go is thewelltheory.com, because that's where you're going to have the banner link to the book, which kind of summarizes my years of research and experience getting people better naturally.
Sure. So you sent us a copy of the PDF of the book, so I got to look over it. So some of these questions are going to be about the book specifically for just if our audience is curious.
Okay.
So in your first chapter, you talk about the roles of MRIs in diagnosing pain issues. Could you explain some of the concerns you have with solely relying on them?
Yeah, so I realized a number of years ago, and there's actually a lot of really decent peer-reviewed literature on this subject. What I realized was that you can get an MRI and you can get a beautiful picture, and it's amazing technology, and you can see into the human body more or less down to, you know, sometimes if the MRI is good enough, you can even see layers of cartilage. So the technology is awesome, but what wasn't working, there was no correlation, and there's still no true correlation between what you see on imaging and how somebody feels. So ortho has still fought today and always followed sort of that mind-body separation, the biomedical approach to care. Like, your shoulder hurts, I see a tear on that MRI, so that must be why your shoulder hurts. Forgetting about everything else about this person, every other attachment there, every other piece of connective tissue, any inflammatory cytokines, anything that has to do with advanced glycation end products from hyperglycemia, things like that. You just focus on what's on an image. The problem with MRIs is they have a very high, what we call false positive rate. So almost everybody has a finding on MRI, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's the true source of a problem. They've done studies on hundreds of people with no pain, and they've done this in the shoulder, the knee, the back, the cervical spine, the foot, the ankle, name a body part. You do MRIs of 100 or 200 people with no pain, and about 50 to 60% of them are going to have a finding, like a torn meniscus, a torn labrum in the hip, arthritis on their ex, whatever. But it doesn't mean that that's the problem, because this is a group of asymptomatic people, people with no pain. So by definition, that means they're false positive findings until proven otherwise, right?
Yep.
Problem is, in medicine nowadays, everything's so cookie cutter and fast paced that you throw up the MRI and you say, oh, you have a disc, we must operate. Oh, you have a meniscal tear, that's why your knee hurts, we must operate. Oh, you have a labral tear in your hip, we must, so on and so, I mean, I could go on and on and on, but I don't believe that's true. And I'm sort of proving that in my practice. And I think there's a few more of us out there, there's a few more orthos starting to think the way I am. And you're starting to see it in the literature more, that you just can't rely on these studies. It's too high of a false positive rate.
Yeah, I remember old patients we had, and they had knee replacements, and they got both knees checked out, and they said, well, the knee that hurts more is in better shape according to imaging. My other knee looks terrible, but it doesn't bother me at all. So
it's amazing.
Yeah,
there is no correlation between what you see on an x-ray and how somebody feels. And nobody to date has ever been able to prove that connection.
So in your clinic now, do you still perform surgeries if needed, or do you just primarily focus on the natural healing aspects?
I mean, I love operating. Don't get me wrong. I love surgery.
Sure.
But what I will tell you, I work very closely with physical therapists. They're actually in the building with me, and we talk all day long, every day. It's not the way it normally is in ortho, as I'm sure you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. We're in the same building. The gym is right next to my exam rooms. And so, you know, to their, I guess, credit and to my detriment, a lot of our patients do get better non-operatively. And so a lot of the run-of-mill surgeries have gone down, but I still teach for LSU. So I still have to treat a lot of old trauma from gunshot wounds and car accidents and people falling off roofs and breaking their calcaneus or things like that. And I do a lot of peripheral nerve surgery for like entrapments and nerve transfers, things like that, some orthoplastics things. But the run-of-the-mill, like, you have knee arthritis, we have been successfully treating it non-surgically, hip arthritis, back pain, neck pain. But yeah, I still operate. There's still always going to be a role for surgery. I personally just think it's a little bit overdone.
Sure. So you mentioned the importance of antioxidants countering chronic inflammation for musculoskeletal health. So why is this so important, and how can people get more antioxidants into their lives?
Okay. So this comes down to what I think is one of the fundamental problems of the musculoskeletal system and why people come into my clinic all stiff and they're achy and they have pain all the time and they creak and they crick, can't do what they wanted to do. If they get on the floor, they can't get up. They can't play with their grandkids. They can't run. There's no more sports in their lives. It's the same fundamental problems that are also giving people diabetes, cancer, dementia, what have you. It's chronic low-grade inflammation and oxidative stress. So what is oxidative stress? This is where antioxidants come into play. When your body makes energy from food, one of the byproducts, I think of it like exhaust from a car when you're running your fuel. one of the byproducts are free radicals, which are unpaired electrons, really, off of molecules. And the body and nature do not like an unpaired electron. So these unpaired electrons are always going to seek a match to make an even number. And what they do is they glom onto the fat of the cellular membranes, the DNA, the proteins in the mitochondria, the proteins in the cell, and they basically start destroying things. So the role of antioxidants, and your body makes its own antioxidants on a daily basis. I mean, we have a system set up to combat this, probably because we evolved, you know, with the sun and all the UV rays and everything. You have a system for that. The problem is, because of our current diet and lifestyles, we have a very low level of natural antioxidants. And the role of antioxidants is to take these unpaired electrons and combine with them and neutralize them effectively. So it's a defense mechanism to protect your DNA, to protect your cellular membrane from destruction, your proteins, your mitochondria. So when you take exogenous or like consume antioxidants, for instance, let's say you eat some blueberries, you're helping your body out tremendously by adding these neutralizing elements, which will combat the oxidative stress from pollution, from stress, from poor diet, from lack of sleep, et cetera, and poorly functioning mitochondria.
So I understand antioxidants help with oxidative stress, but I'm presuming we'll talk about it later. But if you just don't put whatever is causing the oxidative stress into your body in the first place, you can probably don't have to depend upon antioxidants as much.
In theory.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. I mean, think about what's around you. Air pollution, water pollution, chemicals in your food you don't even know about. You know, all these nonstick pans we cook on, it's just putting chemicals in your food, the plastics that everything's packed in. There's the solar radiation. There's a million reasons to get oxidative stress, diet being one of them. And in America, I try to eat as healthy as I can, but it's almost impossible to have a really perfect diet here. If you go to the grocery store, I think it's something like 80% of what is sold in a grocery store is ultra processed, which by definition is going to be pro-oxidative stress, pro-inflammatory. So unless you are uber wealthy, which I'm not, and you have a private chef making all your meals and you have a private home organic garden, you know what I mean? Like not all of us are living on that pedestal. So for me, and what I tell my patients, try to eat 9 servings of organic fruits and vegetables every day, but let's be honest, who can do that in the real world? So one of the other ways to combat it is to take exogenous antioxidants. So for instance, like I take tar cherry extract, I take turmeric, things like that.
Sure. So I can't remember what the study was called a long time ago, but someone had like an antioxidant rich smoothie. They digested it. Their antioxidants, they could chart how many were within their system somehow. They're very high, but then if you have too much at once, it just kind of goes down. So your natural production goes down. Is that something that can be problematic, or is it not really enough science to prove that?
I would go with the latter. I don't know that study off the top of my head. I don't think I read that one. But what I will tell you is a lot of the literature in the nutrition world is, it's not awesome. I think it's good, but it's really hard to study that, right? So the whole medical paradigm is to study one molecule at a time and what does it do to you? You know, measure one biomarker and what does it do to you? But truly healthy people are doing multiple things at once, right? No one's ever going to do that study. It's impossible. Like, how do you study someone that eats healthy, who saunas, who sleeps well, who doesn't smoke? Like, you're never going to have those variables all matched up.
Sure.
Yes, I've heard there's also another study. I want to say it's the Physician's Health Study, where they looked at some doctors and gave them like vitamin E or something and tried to see if it changed their morbidity and mortality. And they said it did not. And that study was used for years to poo-poo antioxidants and say they're worthless and useless. But again, it was a single molecule study. It was a very low dose. There was no mention of anything else about their lives. So it's hard for me to hang my hat on those kind of studies. I just know that my life is very filled with oxidative stress because of stress. I live in South Louisiana. I'm surrounded by chemical plants. We're out in the sun. It's deep south. It's super hot. The food's not so great. It's delicious, but maybe not so healthy for you. And I know that when I started down this path and I started to do everything I was preaching, I just feel better. Like, I haven't had pain in years.
Sure.
You know, I haven't taken an ibuprofen since I can remember.
So in your book, you talk about having a positive mindset. So how can that help someone dealing with musculoskeletal pain issues?
Yeah. So this is a huge issue. and relatively new to orthopedics. It's been in the chronic pain literature and in other industries or medical specialties, I should say, for a while now. It's just now permeating in the ortho. We are now getting study after study after study that shows the primary determinant of your outcomes after surgery. So like, do you have less pain? Do you have more function? Are you happy with your surgery? Did you do well? The primary determinant is your preoperative mental health status. So are you depressed? Do you have anxiety? Are you an optimist? Are you a pessimist? That matters more than my surgical skill. Now, this is hard for most orthos to take because, you know, you want to think that you're the one that's really helping someone. But honestly, at the end of the day, it's that person's mindset and how they feel about life in general. Are they optimistic? And having a positive mindset, and the book details a lot of this and goes into a little bit more in terms of the mechanisms and the science behind it. But you can effectively change what is called descending inhibition or descending amplification of pain signals through mindset and changes in the brain. And it's been shown with functional MRI studies, multiple clinical studies, very well done ones. And so just having a more focused and positive way of being and then learning techniques like mindfulness, things like that to calm down the system, to decrease your sympathetic overtones and increase your parasympathetic, which of course decreases your cortisol levels, which decreases stress and inflammation. All this matters and really dramatically affects how you feel and how you perceive pain. Because remember, pain is really just an electrical signal that goes to the brain. And then the brain decides what to do with that electric signal. It's either going to make it catastrophic and earth ending, or it's just going to make it, oh, that's kind of annoying.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm talking about. So mindset, you really can, we people have way more control over this than our doctors are letting us know.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yeah, I remember in school, we had one of our teachers said, ask a person their pain scale on a Monday and then compare it to their pain scale on a Friday. It's probably higher on the Monday because the weekend's coming on Friday, so they're in a better mood.
That's true. I think that's actually a study. I think the teacher was actually quoting a study. I remember reading that. But it does make a big difference. And I detail in the book little tips and techniques and kind of go into it, as I said. But again, this is something people aren't used to hearing. But think about all of the placebo-controlled trials, right? That's the gold standard. Mm-hmm. The gold standard to study a drug is a placebo-controlled double randomized study, right? Why? Because placebos work. Why? Because the mind is making them work. You just don't know it. So what you can learn is how to sort of control your own placebo effect, I guess, is the best way to think about it.
So many people that have bone-on-bone problems or arthritis typically find things like exercise challenging. From your perspective, is exercise beneficial for these people, and how can they incorporate it into their lives without making their pain worse?
Right. So this is a great, great topic. For years, like during my training and shortly thereafter for a number of years, and only just now am I starting to see this change in the community. Doctors, anytime somebody would come in with an injury or arthritis or whatever, the first thing they would say is stop doing that. Stop playing tennis. Stop playing pickleball. No, you can't run anymore, et cetera, et cetera. However, most of the data shows, and the CDC even has this all over their website, people with arthritis, the ones that exercise have less pain than the ones that do not. And the reason is exercise does a tremendous number of things for the human body from brain health on. But for inflammation specifically, the more you exercise, the more you enter into an anti-inflammatory overall state, which reduces the inflammatory proteins that are causing pain in the joints. If you get stronger, your muscles get stronger. That means your bones are getting stronger too, which also diminishes pain. And you increase I call it like hydraulic shock absorbing around the joints is how I try to explain it to patients. You know, if your quad and your calves are nice and rehabbed and strong, you're by definition going to have less knee pain, but you also have to have strong hips as you're aware and things like that. So exercise diminishes inflammation, increases strength, increases flexibility, also increases mental stress, which which goes to the mindset thing again. So the less mental stress you have, the less depression, the less pain you have. So the way exercise helps you is in many different ways. And for somebody with severe arthritis, what I usually do is just baby steps. I mean, we're talking in the real world, not in the, ivory tower, anti-aging wellness world. You're talking about people that if they're lucky, they get, an hour a day to themselves between taking care of kids, going to work, commuting, shopping, doing errands, right? Most of them are stuck at a desk all day and have grown up eating ultra processed foods. They're highly stressed, highly inflamed. So I've gotten it down to as simple as telling people to set a timer for every hour at your desk and get up and just walk in circles in the office for 5 minutes. Because if you add it up, that's 40 minutes a day of exercise I never did before, just moving. And even just fidgeting increases your lifespan. So if you could add 40 minutes of walking a day, that's a start. And then you build from there. So for the real world, it's baby steps is how I think of it. You just got to start small with simple movement. And then eventually you're going to add resistance exercise, 150 minutes of zone two. For the elite of us, maybe you're going to do some high intensity exercise. But for my patient population, that is not happening. So I just try to get them maybe some zone two a few times a week. You know what I mean? But anything helps. And they've been showing this in more recent studies. Used to be that unless you did 150 minutes a week, you aren't going to get any benefit. Well, now we know that's not true. Even 5 minutes a day is going to help you out a lot.
Yeah. I know what zone two is, but for our audience, could you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah. So a lot of the fitness gurus break aerobic exercise into these zones. Zone two, I think of as being able to talk, but not talk that well. So like you can have a conversation, but you might be a little bit breathless and have to stop and take a breath every now and then. That means your heart rate's up enough to be in zone two, which is kind of when you're in that like fat burning zone.
Yeah. For our listeners, zone one is like a really mild, mild walk. Zone two, it just depends on your fitness level. It's based off of five zones of heart rates. But
right. Like my zone two is probably way different than yours because you're probably in much better shape than I am.
Yeah, it depends on age and your aerobic capacity, right? Essentially. But so in the book, you have a chapter on the importance of diet, which we talked a little bit with antioxidants. Could you share some simple tips for optimizing one's diet?
Yes. So, and again, I go into great detail in the book on this, but my personal favorite for diet, the most approachable, the most studied, the most evidence behind it is a Mediterranean diet or the Mediterranean lifestyle. So this is an omnivore approach. So, there's people that are pro carnivore. There's people that are pro vegetarian, people that are pro vegan. I'm a little bit easier than that and not as strict. And I think Mediterranean is the way to go. And there's a few reasons. The olive oil, which is naturally anti-inflammatory in and of itself, the higher levels of omega-3s, which we don't really talk about yet, but we'll probably talk about if we talk about supplements, which are naturally anti-inflammatory and also will actually help you become more flexible and are good for brain health. And then, of course, the high levels of fiber with the vegetables and fruits. You're supposed to have 9 servings. Again, who can do that? That's impossible, I think, unless you have a private chef. So the Mediterranean diet also emphasizes socializing, spending time with friends and family, and cooking at home. So one of the first things I tell people to do is you just have to start cutting out as many ultra processed foods as you can, no matter what else you want to eat. Like just anything that you don't think is growing on a tree somewhere or close to that. Like there is no Frito-Lay tree or Cheeto tree, right? So if it's something that has to be engineered and made in a factory setting, probably try to avoid it if at all possible. Of course, it's not going to be 100% because that is the vast majority of what's available. But just avoiding those foods is the first tip. The Mediterranean diet's the second. And then I go into a little bit of detail about things like time-restricted eating and intermittent fasting, which to me is the simplest trick. If you're trying to eat less or eat better, just shortening your feeding window just takes a ton of mental stress out of the whole situation. If you just say, I'm going to start eating at 10, I'm going to stop eating at 7 p.m. or 8 p.m., that's it. Then it becomes less important what you eat in that window because the timing is better. But then you're more able to focus during that window on healthier things like trying to eat Mediterranean and not ultra processed. So those three things, time-restricted eating, Mediterranean diet, and avoiding ultra processed foods are probably the main takeaways.
Yeah, you know? I will. I'm not old enough to have arthritis yet, but I have had a couple of hand injuries, and I remember during the recovery process after having surgeries, if I ate bad, my hand would just balloon up and swell and be annoying. And if I ate good, it was normal. So it definitely plays a big role.
Oh, a huge role. I don't know if you remember that movie. I can't remember the guy's name, but where he ate McDonald's for a month and that was it.
Yeah, I think it was Super Size Me.
Yes. It was like hard to watch that. feel worse and worse.
This is a side tangent, but there was another guy that did a study himself. And he only ate McDonald's too, but he didn't overeat. And he was actually okay, which I thought was interesting. But
I'm not sure.
It's pretty hard not to overeat those foods. And I don't feel great when I eat them either. So,
yeah, hugely energy dense. That's what you want to avoid.
Yeah. So, can you explain the benefits of supplements in dealing with joint pain? I know on your site you have lots of different options depending upon certain issues.
Yeah. So, one of the reasons I did this book was to kind of give people a resource they could go back to again and again. And you know, I see 30 patients a day or more, and I don't have time to explain all of this to every patient, although I would like to. That's why I do webinars and things like that for free education. But one of the, I guess the nidus for the book was I started recommending supplements to people because I found that everyone's D deficient. Everybody's magnesium deficient. There's such a wound healing problem. So I figured everybody's got to be zinc deficient, so on and so forth. And so one of the first things I came up with, well, way back in the day, I used to tell people go buy calcium, magnesium, vitamin C, zinc, and then take it all when you're healing from the surgery. Well, people would come in with like a little plastic bag filled with 8 pill bottles. So the first one I came out with was combining all of those basic, supplements that help musculoskeletal surgery heal, which turns out is just helping your immune system, right? Because all of healing and all of fighting coughs and colds and all of fighting pollution, that's all just your immune system. So the only way you heal is with macrophages and neutrophils, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same system, just being applied differently. So for joint pain, you have to reduce inflammation, reduce oxidative stress, and support your connective tissue, support your collagen, right? Vitamin C is integral for the collagen fibers to form the crosslinks that keep it strong, right? You're not going to have good solid collagen without vitamin C. Bone, you're going to need calcium, magnesium, and D3, right? So on and so forth. So the basic fundamental supplements were all designed towards healing, but then to reduce inflammation, omega-3s are naturally anti-inflammatory. So if you can fill your body with more omega-3s, those molecules go down an anti-inflammatory pathway when the immune system is turned on, as opposed to omega-6s, which is what's in soybeans, soy oil, corn oil, most of the processed foods we eat. The omega-6s go down a pro-inflammatory pathway, which ends up being destructive. The omega-3s go down a healing pathway, which ends up being beneficial to us. So just taking omega-3s, you're automatically less inflamed systemically. So that reduces joint pain. And then things that, again, sequester these free radicals, those unpaired electrons that are floating around. So one of my favorites is tart cherry extract, because I used to drink tart cherry juice and think I was doing myself a favor. Well, what is juice but a shot of sugar, right? So once I figured that out, I switched to just taking the extracts and not getting the sugar shot with it. But that increases your ability to harvest and neutralize those unpaired electrons, which, of course, reduces joint pain. Vitamin D3, there's receptors on chondrocytes in the cartilage and on bone cells. So if you're D deficient, your body knows it. Magnesium is a cofactor for like 300 enzymatic reactions. So is zinc. So for you to be able to repair damaged cartilage, repair damaged ligaments and tendons and feel better, you have to have these micronutrients on board, or you just don't have the building blocks to do it. So that's where this all began.
So when it comes to omega-3s and omega-6s, I guess just for our audience, since they're kind of the layperson, those are essentially fatty acids. I know oftentimes in foods, you want to try to have them equal at least, right? Even a lot of foods have more 6 than 3. So what's the role of like omega-6 in the body that's positive? I know you mentioned it could be oxidative.
Yeah, so I mean, omega-6 are the primary ingredient of your cell membrane, the phospholipids that form the surrounding caps. Think of your cell like a water balloon. Mm-hmm. The actual balloon material is a cell membrane.
Sure.
And inside are going to be all your organelles and your mitochondria and everything in the DNA. Well, most membranes, the ratio of omega-6 is always going to be more than omega-3s. Okay. And that's just has to do with where the carbon double bond position is in this polyunsaturated fatty acid. But the problem in our country is we really don't have any omega-3s, unless you're really seeking them, because every ultra processed food is made with the cheaper corn oils and cheaper soybean oils. Nobody's going out and harvesting algae to make potato chips. You know what I mean? So we're all filled with omega-6s, which you need, which are fundamental to your body. But if that's all that your inflammatory pathway has as the first product that the phospholipase A2 enzyme breaks down and turns into prostaglandins and other inflammatory cytokines, if you only have the omega-6 building block, it's going to always go to prostaglandins and always go to these pro-inflammatory damaging cytokines, whereas the omega-3s go to things called resolvins and protectins. I mean, the names just even sound better. The little proteins that induce the healing components of the inflammatory cascade. So you need both, but you know, for instance, the omega-3 index, this is a kind of a way to test how much you have. In Japan, I think their level is like 10 to 12%, something like that. And most Americans are like 3 to 4%. And I may be off a percent or two, but we're just terrible with it. And so as a consequence, our lives are shorter, and that's been shown in studies. It prolongs your life if you have a higher omega-3 index. We feel stiff, because the other thing the omega-3s do inside of that water balloon, the cell membrane, is it makes it more flexible. Omega-6s are very stiff and they don't allow movement. And if you don't have a flexible cell membrane, none of the receptors work right. None of the channels work right. None of the pores for the ions, et cetera, work properly. And then your connective tissues and your collagen gets very stiff. And so you get achy and creaky. And, you know, these are the people that I say, oh, show me where it hurts on your foot. And they literally can't even get down to their foot, and then they can't pull their leg up to touch it with their hand. They have to show me with their other foot because they're so slow. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, yeah. I'm picturing old patients right now.
Yeah. But yeah, you need some omega-6s. We just don't need nearly as many as we're almost like foie gras. Like we're ducks just being force fed all of this crud and then wonder why we feel bad.
Yeah. So what alternative therapies have you found effective when combined with traditional orthopedic treatments? In your book, I know you go into a lot of different subjects here.
Yeah, well, I don't know if this is considered alternative, but my primary go-to is physical therapy, without a doubt. I'm a huge fan of physical therapy and physical medicine. And if you have a good physical therapist, and most of them are pretty good, but if you have one that's like really understands the fascial lines, like the line of fascia that goes from the skull all the way down to the plantar fascia, and all of the interconnections and how it works with the spine in terms of movement and motion, you can really dramatically affect people's lives without surgery. So my first go-to is always physical therapy, with ranging from cupping and dry needling to exercise to stretching to fascial techniques, et cetera. But other techniques that work, I've found success with acupuncture. I try to get people to use saunas, to use cold plunges if they can. Things like infrared light. There's a lot of photoreceptors that we don't even think about that work really, really well. Going out and getting some sunlight in the early morning, making sure you're on a solid sleep schedule. All of these you would consider voodoo and alternative, but there's just a ton of data supporting them, and it really works. And we've been successful here in my clinic, and I know that there's people out there feeling great because they've started to do more of these so-called alternative. And when you say alternative, you mean not pharmaceutical and not surgery, right?
I mean not from the U.S. based, I should say.
Yeah, okay, right. So if you think back how medical school started in this country, which when I learned this, it's kind of, you feel like kind of like somebody's pawn. Rockefeller started the whole world of medical school as we know it, basically to create a sales force for the drugs that his partner at Bayer Pharmaceuticals wanted to sell. So they got together and created medical schools, which effectively made a pharmaceutical sales force. So everything when that happened, and this is back whatever year that was, forever ago, everything after that became so-called alternative, right? But, you know, look at Chinese medicine. It's been around for how many thousands of years? Ayurvedic medicine in India, how many thousands of years? And all those people seem to be healthier than we are. So I don't know. These are the things I sort of think about, that maybe we're not on the right path. Maybe we should incorporate some of these other things I'm not saying all pharmaceuticals are bad by any stretch of the means, but I don't think that's the only answer.
Yeah. I remember years ago, I worked with a retired MD who was in his 80s at the time when I worked with him, and he was just saying how much doctoring has changed and how everything is so, they only know their one little component and then they want to give you a pill for every little thing you have. And he just kind of shook his head at it.
Yes. So there are pills for the side effects of pills for the side effects of pills.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I have patients with a medication list like 40 long. I mean, yeah, that can't be right, but that's what happens.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's convenient and it's what they reimburse for nowadays.
That's the other problem.
Yeah. So you have a section on the Warner Protocol in your book. Could you explain what that is and how it can help with pain?
Yeah, so we sort of, what I did in the book was sort of solidify it into steps, but not necessarily sequential steps. I mean, there's a recommendation of get the mindset right first, et cetera. But if, for instance, if you're a shift worker, it's really hard to get a solid, good sleep schedule, right? But at least if you do the other steps in the protocol, you'll feel a lot better. Ideally, you would get off of shift work at some point and get on a solid circadian rhythm, which is hugely important. But we came up with an acronym, MEDS, MEDS, so for mindset, exercise, diet, sleep, and then break those bigger sections into smaller steps that people can take. It's sort of a lifestyle change. And I try to emphasize in the book, this is not like a contest or competition, or if you don't do all of this all at once perfectly, you're a failure. It's more like if you even did like part of each step, you would feel tremendously better. And I'm not saying everyone's going to not need surgery if they read this book, but the beauty of it is if you follow the protocol, your outcomes will be better from whatever given surgery you really are indicated for. So it's win-win in my opinion. And all the protocol does is just simplifies it and puts it into steps.
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes, you know, working in physical therapy, we've seen people after, you know, knee replacements, joint replacements, whatever they had, and then they get better and they feel a lot better. But then after time, issues arise because they still have something going on. Either they're still pro-inflammatory in their diet or they still have some type of, you know, tightness or issues in their muscles and ligaments around it, which are still problematic. So following what you're recommending can be beneficial even if you have surgery.
100%. Yes. And as you know, and the literature supports, 1 out of 5 people after total joint surgery is not happy. They don't have the outcome they wanted. It's so 20% is pretty, that's not solid. You know, the survivorship is 95, 98%, right? So that means they don't need a revision and the x-rays look good. But clinically, 20% aren't happy, and probably for the reasons you're saying, which, yes, the protocol will help those folks as well, because I have those patients.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the few that get a knee replacement, and then they're like, I'm taller on this side now, and they get a little.
That's always not a desired outcome. We'll just say that.
So are there situations, I know you did mention this a little bit earlier, where surgery might be the best option for a patient? And if so, what are those circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, if you're 70 and you fall and you break your hip, there's no question that surgery is the answer there. You need to get either the hip replaced or the hip repaired, depending on, you know, the underlying arthritis and age and different factors. If you have a foot drop, you probably need to get that fixed. And I'm trying, you know, foot drop is when one is unable to pull the foot up to clear the floor when they're walking and they tend to trip. And that ranges from, you know, an L5 radiculopathy from a spinal disc to a peroneal nerve entrapment. Those kind of things require surgery. Sometimes you really do have a true injury, like a massive ankle dislocation or some kind of massive ankle sprain that doesn't get better, and you have recurrent instability, things like that. So like I said, I think there's always going to be a role for surgery. I just think for the elective surgeries that are performed for aches and pains and like the stiffness and just the general what is normally associated with age, but I don't really practice ageism. So I think it's really more prolonged lifestyle, but it can be reversed. Those kind of things, I think you really should seek to not have surgery for a number of reasons. Surgery is expensive. It's a lot of downtime. It's not without risk. It's not, anesthesia is not without risk. There's a lot of brain changes that happen after anesthesia that you don't really want. It's annoying, it's inconvenient, et cetera, you know? So my goal is really just to empower people to have the choice. You don't have to have surgery just because somebody said you do. If that ends up being the right choice for you, great. But here's another option you could also try.
Sure. Yeah. And most of your options, I mean, they're not going to have a negative effect on you, even if they don't make your pain completely disappear.
Right. And I go into that in the book as well. The side effect of following this protocol to avoid orthopedic surgery and to feel better physically, the side effects are less risk of dementia, less risk of cardiovascular disease, less risk of diabetes, less risk of cancer, on and on and on. All of what we call the non-communicable chronic diseases. Okay. Stuff you can't catch, but that are scourges of society right now.
Sure. So if someone is unsure about undergoing surgery, what one piece of advice would you recommend for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think we live in really a scary time because of the internet and the availability of things like podcasts and YouTube, but it's also a great time because people really can educate themselves now. I mean, think about before Google, which is in my lifetime, you had to literally go to the library and sometimes go to the microfiche machine. Like you had to go find the book with the Dewey Decimal System, et cetera, et cetera. Now you can just click on a YouTube video and watch somebody talk about inflammatory stress all day long. So the first thing is to educate yourself. And my patients are great at this. They love reading. They love learning. The second thing I would tell people, and I do this all the time, is get another opinion. You know, go get an academic medical opinion versus a private practice or one of each, because it's two different schools of thought and there's a lot of groupthink in medicine. And then the third thing I would suggest is bring somebody with you to the visit. You know, maybe they don't talk during the visit, but maybe you can just bounce ideas off of them afterwards, like just a different perspective, you know, so that you're really making an informed decision. That's the other purpose of this book, is really to let people really be informed for that so-called informed consent, which really isn't that informed if you think about it, because who knows about the false positive rates of MRIs? Who knows about the fact that your surgical indication is based on where you live, not your actual problem? And that's been shown in very large, big database studies from like Dartmouth and other places like that. Who knows all this? Nobody does. So I'm just trying to spell it out really to help people be more educated and empower themselves.
Is there anything else from the book you would like to mention that I haven't asked?
Oh my goodness. You asked a lot of really good questions. I think we talked about pretty much everything. I guess what I really want people to know is this is meant to be approachable and uplifting. Like, not a very type A regimented, if you don't do this, you're going to feel terrible kind of a book, you know, because there's enough of those. This is more like, here's some good ideas for you. And honestly, it really comes down to common sense. And I feel like when I wrote the book and when I read it after all the editing and publishing process, it's basically what my parents told me. Eat your vegetables, go to bed early, calm down. You know, it's like all common sense, but now we've got data and science, and I talk about how the mechanisms work and how this really, you know, how mindset really does work. Why does sleep really help you? Kind of explains it all and gives you like a guideline. But I mean, I hope people take it as an approachable and, I guess, positive tool, really.
Sure. So would you mind mentioning your website again?
Oh, sure. It's thewelltheory.com.
And they can find your book. I know we have a link that your assistant just sent us, so we'll link it down below if you want to pre-order the book. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. Did you have any more questions for me?
I don't think so.
Great questions.